He'd seen few newspapers through the winter, but even so, the level of disagreement between the governor and the assembly was clear. He'd resorted to a practice of continuous proroguing, repeatedly dismissing the assembly in order to prevent them passing legislation at odds with his desires. I could well imagine what the public response would be to the revelation that he contemplated arming the Cherokee, Catawba, and Creek, and inciting them against his own people. "I'm guessing that he isn't actually going to do that," I said, finding the blue ribbon I was looking for. "Because if he had, does, I mean, the revolution would have got going in North Carolina right now, rather than in Massachusetts or Philadelphia 2 years from now. But why on earth is he publishing these letters in the newspaper?" Jamie laughed. He shook his head, pushing back the disheveled hair from his face.
"He's not. Evidently the governor's mail is being intercepted. He's no very pleased about it, MacDonald says."
"I dare say not. Mail was notoriously insecure, and always had been. In fact, we had originally acquired Fergus when Jamie hired him as a pickpocket, in order to steal letters in Paris." "How is Fergus doing?" I asked. Jamie made a small grimace, pulling on his stockings.
"Better, I think. Massali says he's staying more to home, which is good. And he's earning a wee bit, teaching French to Hiram Crombie, but..."
"Hiram? French?"
"Why?"
He grinned at me.
"Hiram's set upon the idea that he must go and preach to the Indians, and he thinks he'll be best equipped to manage it if he's got some French as well as English. Ian's teaching him a bit of the Jalagi, too, but there are so many Indian tongues he'd never learn them all."
"Will wonders never cease?" I murmured. "Do you think..." I was interrupted at this point by Mrs. Bug bellowing up the stairs. "If certain persons are wanting to let a good breakfast be spoilt, I'm sure they're welcome." Like clockwork, Major MacDonald's door popped open, and his feet clattered eagerly down the stairs. "Ready?" I said to Jamie. He seized my hairbrush and tidied himself with a few licks, then came to open the door and bowed, ushering me ceremoniously out.
"What you said, Sassenach," he said, as he followed me down the stair, "about it starting in 2 years. It's already well begun. You know that, eh?"
"Oh, yes," I said, rather grimly. "But I don't want to think about it on an empty stomach." Roger stood up straight, measuring. The edge of the kiln pit he stood in came just under his chin. 6 feet would be just about at eye level. Only a few more inches then. That was heartening. Setting the shovel against the dirt wall, he stooped, grabbed a wooden bucket full of earth, and heaved it up over the rim.
"Dirt!" he yelled.
There was no response to his shout. He rose on his toes, peering balefully round for his so-called assistants. Jemmy and Germaine were meant to be taking it in turn to empty the buckets and pass them back down to him, but had a tendency to vanish abruptly.
"Dirt!"
he shouted, as loudly as he could. The wee buggers couldn't have gone far. It took him less than 2 minutes to fill a bucket. This call was answered, but not by the boys. A cold shadow fell over him, and he squinted up to see the silhouette of his father-in-law stooping to grab the handle of the bucket. Jamie strode 2 paces and flung the dirt onto the slowly mounting heap, then came back, hopping down into the pit to return it.
"A tidy wee hole you have here," he said, turning round to survey it. "You could barbecue an ox in it." "I'll need one. I'm starving."
Roger wiped a sleeve across his forehead. The spring day was cool and crisp, but he was drenched with sweat. Jamie had picked up his shovel and was examining the blade with interest.
"I've never seen the like. Is it the lass's work?" "With a bit of help from Di Jones, aye."
It had taken roughly 30 seconds' work with an 18th-century shovel to convince Brianna that improvements could be made. It had taken 3 months to acquire a chunk of iron that could be shaped to her directions by the blacksmith, and to persuade Di Jones, who was Welsh, and thus by definition stubborn, into doing it. The normal spade was made of wood,
and looked like nothing so much as a roof shingle attached to a pole. "May I try?" Enchanted, Jamie drove the pointed end of the new spade into the dirt at his feet.
"Be my guest."
Roger scrambled up out of the deep part of the pit into the shallower end of the kiln. Jamie stood in the part where the fire would go, according to Brianna, with a chimney to be raised over it. Items to be fired would sit in the longer, relatively shallow part of the pit and be covered over. After a week of shoveling, Roger was less inclined to think the distant possibility of plumbing was worth all the labour involved. But Bree wanted it, and, like her father, Bree was difficult to resist, though their methods varied. Jamie shoveled briskly, tossing spades full of dirt into the bucket, with small exclamations of delight and admiration at the ease and speed with which dirt could be dug. Despite his dim view of the occupation, Roger felt a sense of pride in his wife's implements.
"First the wee matchsticks," Jamie said, making a joke of it.
"Now shovels.
What will she think of next?" "I'm afraid to ask," Roger said, with a tinge of rue that made Jamie laugh.
The bucket filled, Roger picked it up and took it to empty, while Jamie filled the second. And without spoken agreement, they continued the job, Jamie digging, Roger carrying, finishing in what seemed no time at all. Jamie climbed out of the pit and joined Roger on the edge, looking down at their handiwork in satisfaction.
"And if it doesn't work well as a kiln," Jamie observed, "she can make a root cellar of it." "Waste not, want not," Roger agreed.
They stood, looking down into the hole, the breeze chilly through their damp shirts now that they'd stopped moving.
"Do you think you might go back, you and the lass?" Jamie said.
He spoke so casually that Roger missed his meaning at first, not catching on until he saw his father-in-law's face, set in the imperturbable calm that, he'd learned to his cost, generally covered some strong emotion.
"Back?"
he repeated uncertainly. Surely he didn't mean. But of course he did.
"Through the stones, do you mean?"
Jamie nodded, seeming to find some fascination in the walls of the pit, where drying grass rootlets hung in tangles, and the jagged edges of stones protruded from the patchy, damp dirt.
"I've thought of it," Roger said, after a pause. "We've thought, but..."
He let his voice trail off, finding no good way to explain. Jamie nodded again, though as if he had. He supposed Jamie and Claire must have discussed it, even as he and Bree had, playing over the pros and cons. The dangers of the passage. And he didn't underestimate those dangers, the more so in light of what Claire had told him about Donna and his comrades. What if he made it through, and Bree and Jem didn't? It didn't bear thinking. Beyond that, if they all survived the passage, was the pain of separation. And he would admit that it would be painful for him as well. Whatever its limitations or inconveniences, the ridge was home. Against those considerations, though, stood the dangers of the present time, for the four horsemen of the apocalypse rode widely here. It was no trick to catch a glimpse of pestilence or famine from the corner of your eye. And the pale horse and its rider were inclined to show up unexpectedly, and often. But that's what Jamie meant, of course, he realized belatedly.
"Because of the war, you mean?"
"The O'Briens," Jamie said quietly. "That will happen again, Ken. Many times."
It was spring now, not autumn. But the cold wind that touched his bones was the same as the one that had blown brown and golden leaves across the face of the little girl. Roger had a sudden vision of the two of them, Jamie and himself, standing now at the edge of this cavernous hole, like bedraggled mourners at a graveside. He turned his back on the pit, looking instead into the budding green of the chestnut trees.
"You know," he said, after a moment's silence, "when I first learned what Claire is, what we are, all about it, I thought, how fascinating, to actually see history in the making. I mean, in all honesty, I maybe came as much for that as for Bree. Then, I mean.
Jamie laughed shortly, turning round as well.
Oh, aye. And is it?
Fascinating.
More than I ever thought, Roger assured him with extreme dryness. But why are you asking now? I told you a year ago that we'd stay.
Jamie nodded, pursing his lips.
You did.
The thing is, I am thinking I must sell one or more of the gemstones. That brought Roger up a bit. He'd not consciously thought it, of course, but the knowledge that the gems were there, in case of need. He hadn't realised what a sense of security that knowledge had held until this moment.
They're yours to sell, he replied, cautious. Why now, though? A thing's difficult.
Jamie gave him an exceedingly wry look.
Difficult, he repeated.
Aye, you could say that.
And proceeded to lay out the situation succinctly. The marauders had destroyed not only a season's whisky in the making, but also the malting shed, only now rebuilding. That meant no surplus of the lovely drink this year to sell or trade for necessities. There were 22 more tenant families on the ridge to be mindful of, most of them struggling with a place and a profession that they could never have imagined, trying merely to keep alive long enough to learn how to stay that way.
And then, Jamie added grimly, there's MacDonald. Speak of the devil.
The Major himself had come out onto the stoop, his red coat bright in the morning sun. He was dressed for travel, Roger saw, booted and spurred, and wearing his wig, laced hat in hand.
A flying visit, I see.
Jamie made a small, uncouth noise.
Long enough to tell me I must try to arrange the purchase of 30 muskets with shot and powder. At my own expense, mind. To be repaid by the Crown, eventually, he added, in a cynical tone that made it obvious how remote he considered this eventuality to be. 30 muskets?
Roger contemplated that, pursing his own lips in a soundless whistle. Jamie hadn't been able even to afford to replace the rifle he had given Bird for his help in the matter of Brownsville. Jamie shrugged.
And then there are wee matters, like the dowry I've promised Lizzie Weems. She'll be wed this summer. And Masali's mother, Lyra.
He glanced warily at Roger, unsure how much he might know regarding Lyra.
More than Jamie would be comfortable knowing, Roger thought, and tactfully kept his face blank. I owe a bit to her, for maintenance. We can live, aye, with what we've got. But for the rest, I must sell land, or the stones. And I will not give up the land.
His fingers drummed restlessly against his thigh, then stopped as he raised his hand to wave to the Major, who had just spotted them across the clearing.
I see. Well, then.
Plainly, it had to be done. It was foolish to sit on a fortune in gems, merely because they might one day be needed for a far-fetched and risky purpose. Still, the notion made Roger feel slightly hollow, like rappelling down a cliff and having someone cut your safety line. Jamie blew out his breath.
Well, so, I'll send one with Bobby Higgins to his lordship in Virginia. He'll get me a good price, at least. Aye, that's,
Roger halted, his attention deflected by the scenario unfolding before him. The Major, obviously well-breakfasted and cheerful, had come down the steps and was strolling toward them, oblivious of the white sow who had emerged from her den beneath the foundation and was ambling along the side of the house, bent on her own breakfast. It would be a matter of seconds before she spotted the Major.
Hoy!
Roger bellowed, and felt something tear in his throat. The pain was so sharp that it stopped him cold, and he clutched at his throat, struck suddenly mute.
"Where the pig?" Jamie was shouting, waving and pointing.
The Major thrust his head forward, hand behind his ear, then caught the repeated bellows of "Pig!" and looked wildly round, just in time to see the white sow break into a ponderous trot,
scything her tusks from side to side. He would have been best served by wheeling and sprinting back to the safety of the stoop, but instead panic struck him, and he ran away from the pig, coming straight for Jamie and Roger, who promptly ran in different directions. Glancing back, Roger saw the Major gaining on the pig with long-legged leaps, his goal evidently the cabin. Between the Major and the cabin, though, lay the open hole of the groundhog kiln, masked by the heavy growth of long spring grass through which the Major bounded. "Bet!" Roger shouted. Only the word came out in a strangled croak. Nonetheless, MacDonald seemed to hear him, for a bright red face turned in his direction, eyes bulging. It must have sounded like pig, for the Major glanced back over his shoulder then to see the sow trot faster, small pink eyes fixed on him with murderous intent. The distraction proved nearly fatal, for the Major's spurs caught and tangled, and he sprawled headlong in the grass, losing his grip on the laced hat, which he had held throughout the chase, and sending it pinwheeling through the air. Roger hesitated for an instant, but then ran back to help with a smothered oath. He saw Jamie running back too, spade held at the ready, though even a metal shovel seemed pitifully inadequate to deal with a 500-pound hog. MacDonald was already scrambling to his feet, though. Before either of them could reach him, he took off running as though the devil himself were breathing on his coattails. Arms pumping and face set in puce determination, he ran for his life, bounding like a jackrabbit through the grass, and disappeared. One instant he was there, and the next he had vanished as though by magic. Jamie looked wide-eyed at Roger, then at the pig, who had stopped short on the far side of the kiln pit. Then, moving gingerly, one eye always on the pig, he sidled toward the pit, glancing sideways, as though afraid to see what lay at the bottom. Roger moved to stand at Jamie's shoulder, looking down. Major MacDonald had fallen into the deeper hole at the end, where he lay curled up like a hedgehog, arms clasped protectively over his wig, which had remained in place by some miracle, though now much bespattered with dirt and bits of grass. "MacDonald," Jamie called down, "are you damaged, man?"
"Is she there?"
quavered the Major, not emerging from his ball. Roger glanced across the pit at the pig, now some distance away, snout down in the long grass.
"Aye, she is."
To his surprise, his voice came easy, if a little hoarse. He cleared his throat and spoke a little louder.
"You need no worry, though. She's busy eating your hat."
Chapter 41. The Gunsmith. Jamie accompanied MacDonald as far as Coopersville, where he set the Major on the road back to Salisbury, equipped with food, a disreputable slouched hat against the weather, and a small bottle of whiskey to fortify his bruised spirits. Then, with an internal sigh, he turned into the MacGillivray's place. Robin was at work in his forge, surrounded by the smells of hot metal, wood shavings, and gun oil. A lanky young man with a hatchet face was working the leather bellows, though his dreamy expression showed a certain lack of attention to the job. Robin caught the shadow of Jamie's entrance and glanced up, gave a quick nod, and returned to his work. He was hammering bar iron into flat bands. The iron cylinder he meant to wrap them round to form a gun barrel was waiting, propped between two blocks. Jamie moved carefully out of range of flying sparks and sat down on a bucket to wait. That was Senger's betrothed at the bellows. Heinrich Strasser. He picked the name unerringly out of the hundreds he carried in his mind, and along with it came automatically all he knew of young Heinrich's history, family and connections, these appearing in his imagination round the boy's long, dreamy face in a constellation of social affinities, orderly and complex as the pattern of a snowflake. He always saw people in this way, but seldom thought of it consciously. There was something about the shape of Strasser's face, though, that reinforced the mental imagery. The long axis of forehead, nose and chin, emphasized by a horsey upper lip, deeply grooved, the horizontal axis shorter, but no less sharply defined by long, narrow eyes and flat, dark brows above them. He could see the boy's origins, the middle of nine children, but the eldest boy, son of an overbearing father, and a mother who dealt with this by means of subterfuge and quiet malice. Sprouting in a delicate array from the rather pointed top of his head, his religion, Lutheran, but slack about it. A lacy spray under an equally pointed chin, his relation with Robin, cordial but wary, as befitted a new son-in-law who was also an apprentice. Extending like a fan spike from his right ear, that with Uta, a mix of terror and helpless abashment from the left. This notion entertained him very much, and he was obliged to look away, affecting interest in Robin's workbench in order to keep from staring and rendering the lad uncomfortable. The gunsmith wasn't tidy. Scraps of wood and metal lay among the jumble of spikes, scribes, hammers, blocks of wood, bits of filthy garnet cloth, and sticks of charcoal on the bench. A few papers were weighted down with a spoiled gun stock that had split in the making, their dirty edges fluttering in the hot breath of the forge. He would have taken no notice, save that he recognized the style of the drawing, would have known that boldness and delicacy of line anywhere. Frowning, he rose and pulled the papers from under the gun stock. Drawings of a gun executed from different angles. A rifle. There was the cutaway interior of the barrel, the grooves and landings clear, but most peculiar. One drawing showed it whole, reasonably familiar, bar the odd horn-like growths on the barrel. But the next? The gun seemed as though someone had broken it over his knee. It was snapped through, stock and barrel pointing downward in opposite directions, joined only by... What sort of hinge was that? He closed one eye, considering. The cessation of clamour from the forge and the loud hiss of hot metal in the sump broke his fascination with the drawings and made him look up.
"Did your lass show you those?"
Robin asked, with a nod at the papers. He pulled the tail of his shirt up from behind his leather apron and mopped steam from his sweating face, looking amused.
"No. What is she about? Is she wanting you to make her a gun?"
He relinquished the sheets to the gunsmith, who shuffled through them, sniffing with interest.
"Oh, she's no way of paying for that, McDo, unless Roger Max discovered a pot of fairy gold since last week. No. She's only been telling me her notions of improvement in the art of riflery, asking what it might cost to make such a thing."
The cynical smile that had been lurking in the corner of Robin's mouth broadened into a grin, and he shoved the papers back at Jamie.
"I can tell she's yours, McDo. What other lass would spend her time thinking of guns rather than gowns and bairns?"
There was more than a little implied criticism in this remark. Brianna had undoubtedly been a good deal more forthright in manner than was becoming. But he let it pass for the moment. He needed Robin's goodwill.
"Well, any woman has her fancies," he observed mildly. "Even wee Lizzie, I suppose. But Manfred will see to that, I'm sure. He'll be in Salisbury just now, or Hillsborough."
Robin MacGillivray was by no means a stupid man. The abrupt transition of subject made him arch one brow, but he passed no remark. Instead, he sent Heinrich off to the house to fetch them some beer, waiting for the lad to disappear before turning back to Jamie, expectant.
"I need 30 muskets, Robin," he said, without preamble. "And I'll need them quickly, within 3 months."
The gunsmith's face went comically blank with astonishment, but only for a moment. He blinked then, and closed his mouth with a snap, resuming his usual expression of sardonic good humour.
"Starting your own army, are you, McDo?"
Jamie merely smiled at that without answering. If word got around that he meant to arm his tenantry and muster his own committee of safety in answer to Richard Brown's banditry, that would do nae harm, and might do good. letting word get out that the governor was working secretly to arm the savages in case he required to suppress an armed rising in the back country, and that he, Jamie Fraser, was the agent of such action. That was an excellent way to get himself killed, and his house burnt to the ground, to say nothing of what other trouble might ensue.
How many can you find for me, Robin, and how fast?
The gunsmith squinted, thinking, then darted a sideways glance at him.
Cash?
He nodded, seeing Robin's lips purse in a soundless whistle of astonishment.
Robin kent as well as anyone that he had no money to speak of, let alone the small fortune required to assemble that many guns.
He could see the speculation in Robin's eyes as to where he might be planning to acquire that sort of money, but the gunsmith said nothing aloud. McGillivray's upper teeth sank into his lower lip in concentration, then relaxed.
"I can find 6, maybe 7, betwixt Salisbury and Salem. Brugger, naming the Moravian gunsmith, would do 1 or 2, if it kent it was for you."
Seeing the infinitesimal shake of Jamie's head, he nodded in resignation.
"Aye, well, maybe 7 then. And Manfred and I can manage maybe 3 more. It's only muskets you're wanting, nothing fancy."
He tilted his head toward Brianna's drawing with a small flash of his earlier humour.
"Nothing fancy," Jamie said, smiling. "That's 10 then."
He waited. Robin sighed, settling himself.
"I'll ask about," he said, "but it's no an easy matter, particularly if you dinna mean your name to be heard in connection. And I gather you don't." "You're a man o' rare wit and discretion, Robin,"
Jamie assured him gravely, making him laugh. It was true, for all that. Robin McGillivray had fought beside him at Culloden, lived 3 years with him in Ardsmuir. Jamie would trust him with his life, and was. He began to wish the pig had eaten MacDonald after all, but put the unworthy thought from his mind, and drank the beer Heinrich brought, chatting of inconsequence and trivia until it was polite to take his leave. He had ridden Gideon to bear MacDonald company on his horse, but meant to leave him in Di Jones's barn. Through a complex bit of bargaining, Gideon would cover John Woolham's spotted mare, to be brought up when Woolham returned from Bear Creek, and when the harvest was in come autumn, Jamie would collect 100 weight of barley, with a bottle of whisky to Di for his assistance. Exchanging a bit of conversation with Di, he could never decide whether the blacksmith was truly a man of few words, or was it only that he despaired of making the Scots understand his Welsh sing-song, Jamie slapped Gideon encouragingly on the neck and left him to eat grain and fettle his loins against the coming of the spotted mare. Di had offered him food, but he declined. He was peckish, but looked forward to the peace of the 5-mile walk home. The day was fine and pale blue, with the spring leaves murmuring to themselves overhead, and a bit of solitude would be welcome. The decision had been made when he asked Robin to find him guns, but the situation bore thought. There were 64 villages of the Cherokee, each with its own headman, its own peace chief and war chief. Only 5 of those villages were within his power to influence, the 3 villages of the Snowbird people and 2 that belonged to the Overhill Cherokee. Those, he thought, would follow the leaders of the Overhill, regardless of his words. Roger Mack had known relatively little of the Cherokee, or what their role might be in the looming fight. He had been able to say only that the Cherokee had not acted en masse. Some villages chose to fight, some did not. Some fought for one side, some for another.
Well, so. It wasn't likely that anything he said or did would turn the tide of war, and that was a comfort.
But he couldn't escape the knowledge that his own time to jump was coming. So far as anyone knew now, he was a loyal subject to His Majesty, a Tory, beavering away in Geordie's interest, suborning savages and distributing guns with an eye to suppressing the riotous passions of regulators, Whigs,
and would-be Republicans. At some point, this facade must necessarily crumble to reveal him as a dyed-in-the-wool rebel and a traitor. But when? He wondered idly whether he might have a price on his head this time, and how much it would be. It might not be so difficult with the Scots. Grudge-bearing and hard-headed as they were, he was one of them, and personal liking might moderate the sense of outrage at his turning rebel when the time came. No, it was the Indians he worried over, for he came to them as the agent of the king. How suddenly to explain his change of heart, and further, do it in such a way that they might share it. Surely they would see this as treachery at worst, grossly suspicious behaviour at best. He thought they wouldn't kill him. But how in God's name to induce them to fall in with the cause of rebellion when they enjoyed a stable and prosperous relation with His Majesty? Oh, God. And there was John. What could he say to his friend when the time came? Convince him by logic and rhetoric to change his coat as well? He hissed through his teeth and shook his head in consternation, trying and failing utterly to envision John Grey, lifelong soldier, ex-royal governor, that very soul of loyalty and honour, suddenly declaring himself for rebellion and republic. He passed on, fretting in this fashion for some time, but gradually found the walking soothe his mind and the peace of the day lighten his heart. There would be time before supper to take wee Jem fishing, he thought. The sun was bright, but there was a certain dampness to the air under the trees that was promising for a first hatch of flies on the water. He had a feeling in his bones that the trout would rise near sunset. In this more pleasant frame of mind, he was glad to meet his daughter some little way below the ridge. His heart lifted at sight of her hair, streaming wanton down her back in ruddy glory. "Ki amur a hau, Anian," he said, kissing her cheek in greeting. "Hamiga ma, maha." And she smiled, but he noted a small frown that troubled the smooth flesh of her forehead like the hatch of mayfly on a trout pond. "I've been waiting for you," she said, taking his arm. "I wanted to talk to you before you go to the Indians tomorrow." And there was that in her tone that drove all thought of fish from his mind upon the instant.
"Why?"
She nodded, but seemed to have some difficulty in finding words, an occurrence that alarmed him still further. But he couldn't help her without some notion what it was about, and so kept pace with her, silent but encouraging. A mockingbird was busy nearby, practising its repertoire of calls. It was the bird who lived in the red spruce behind the house. He knew, because it paused now and then in the midst of its chatter and trilling, to give a fine imitation of Adso the cat's midnight yowl. "When you talked to Roger about the Indians," Brianna said finally, and turned her head to look at him, "did he mention something called the Trail of Tears?"
"No," he said, curious. "What's that?"
She grimaced, hunching her shoulders in a way that seemed disconcertingly familiar. "I thought maybe he hadn't. He said he'd told you all he knew about the Indians and the Revolution. Not that he knows all that much. It wasn't his specialty. But this happened. Will happen later, after the Revolution. So maybe he didn't think it was important. Maybe it's not." She hesitated, as though wanting him to tell her that it wasn't. He only waited, though, and she sighed, looking at her feet as she paced along. She was wearing sandals without stockings, and her long bare toes were grimed with the soft dust of the wagon road. The sight of her feet always filled him with an odd mixture of pride at their elegant shape, and a faint sense of shame at their size. But as he was responsible for both, he supposed he had no grounds for complaint. "About 60 years from now," she said at last, eyes on the ground, "the American government will take the Cherokee from their land and move them a long way, to a place called Oklahoma. It's 1,000 miles at least, and hundreds of them will starve and die on the way.
That's why they called it, will call it, the Trail of Tears. He was impressed to hear that there should be a government capable of doing such a thing, and said so. She shot him an angry glance. They'll do it by cheating. They'll talk some of the Cherokee leaders into agreeing by promising them things and not keeping their bargain. He shrugged.
That's how most governments behave, he observed mildly. Why are you telling me this, lass? I will, thank God, be safely dead before any of it happens.
He saw a flicker across her face at mention of his death, and was sorry to have caused her distress by his levity. Before he could apologize, though, she squared her shoulders and went on. I'm telling you because I thought you should know, she said. Not all of the Cherokee went. Some of them went farther up into the mountains and hid. The army didn't find them.
I?
She turned her head and gave him a look from those eyes that were his own, touching in their earnestness.
Don't you see? Mama told you what would happen about Culloden. You couldn't stop it, but you saved Lallybroch. And your men, your tenants. Because you knew.
Oh, Christ, he said, realizing with a shock what she meant. Recollection washed through him in a flood. The terror and desperation and uncertainty of that time. The numb despair that had carried him through that last fatal day.
You want me to tell Bert?
She rubbed a hand over her face and shook her head.
I don't know. I don't know if you should tell him. Or if you do, whether he'll listen. But Roger and I talked about it after you asked him about the Indians. And I kept thinking about it. And, well, it just didn't seem right to know and not do anything. So I thought I'd better tell you.
Aye, I see, he said a little bleakly. He had noticed before the inclination of persons with tender consciences to ease their discomfort by handing the necessity of taking action on to someone else, but forbore to mention it. She could hardly be telling Bert herself, after all. As though the situation he faced with the Cherokee were not sufficiently difficult already, he thought wryly. Now he must deal with saving unknown future generations of savages. The mockingbird zoomed past his ear, unnervingly close, clucking like a hen, of all things. It was so incongruous that he laughed, and then realized that there was nothing else to do. Not now. Brianna was looking at him curiously.
What are you going to do?
He stretched himself, slowly, luxuriously, feeling the muscles of his back pull upon his bones, feeling each of them alive and solid. The sun was coming down the sky, supper was beginning to cook, and for now, for this one last night, he need do nothing. Not yet. I'm going fishing, he said, smiling at his lovely, unlikely, problematical daughter. Fetch the wee lad, aye? I'll get the pools. James Fraser, Esquire, from Fraser's Ridge. To my Lord John Grey, Mount Josiah Plantation, this second day of April, Anno Domini 1774. My Lord, I depart in the morning to visit the Cherokee, and so leave this with my wife to be entrusted to Mr. Higgins when he shall next arrive, to be delivered with its accompanying parcel into your hands. I presume upon your kindness and your solicitude for my family in asking your favour to help in selling the object I entrust to you. I suspect that your connections might enable you to obtain a better price than I might do myself, and to do so discreetly. I shall hope upon my return to confide in you the reasons for my action, as well as certain philosophical reflections which you may find of interest. In the meantime, believe me ever, your most affectionate friend and humble servant, J. Fraser.
Chapter 42. Dress Rehearsal.
Bobby Higgins looked uneasily at me over his mug of beer.
"Beg pardon, Mum," he said, "but you wouldn't be a-thinking of practising some type of physic upon me, would you? The worms are gone, I'm sure of it. And the other."
He blushed slightly and squirmed upon the bench.
"That's quite all right, too. I've ate so many beans I fart quite regular, and not a touch of the fiery knives about it."
Jamie had frequently remarked upon the transparency of my features, but this was surprising perspicacity on Bobby's part.
"I'm thrilled to hear it," I said, evading his question momentarily. "You look quite in the pink of health, Bobby."
He did. The hollow, wasted look had left him, and his flesh was firm and solid, his eyes bright. The blind one hadn't gone milky, nor did it wander perceptibly. He must have some residual ability to detect light and shape, which strengthened my original diagnosis of a partially detached retina. He nodded warily and took a sip of beer, still keeping his eyes fixed on me.
"I'm very well indeed, Mum," he said.
"Splendid. You don't happen to know how much you weigh, do you, Bobby?" The look of wariness vanished, replaced by modest pride.
"Happen I do, Mum. I took some fleeces to the river port for his lordship last month, and was a mercer there, what had a scale for weighing out tobacco or rice or blocks of indigo, as might be. Some of us fellows got to wagering for sport what this or that might weigh, and, well, 10 stone 4 it is, Mum."
"Very nice," I said with approval.
"Lord John's cook must be feeding you well."
I thought he couldn't have weighed more than 110 pounds when I first saw him. 144 was still on the light side for a man of nearly 6 feet, but it was a major improvement. And a real stroke of luck that he should have known his weight exactly. Of course, if I didn't act fast, he might easily gain a stone or two.
Mrs. Bugg had set herself to outdo Lord John's Indian cook, of whom we had heard much, and to this end was shovelling eggs, onions, venison, and a slice of leftover pork pie onto Bobby's plate, to say nothing of the basket of fragrant muffins already in front of him.
Lizzie, seated beside me, took one of these and spread it with butter. I noted with approval that she too was looking healthier, delicately flushed, though I must remember to take a sample to check the malarial parasites in her blood. That would be an excellent thing to do while she was out. No way of getting an exact weight for her, unfortunately, but she couldn't weigh more than 7 stone, small and light-boned as she was. Now, Bree and Roger, at the other end of the scale. Roger had to weigh at least 185. Bree, probably 150. I took a muffin myself, thinking how best to bring up my plan.
Roger would do it if I asked, of course.
But Bree, I'd have to be careful there. She'd had her tonsils out under ether at the age of 10 and hadn't liked the experience. If she found out what I was up to and began expressing her opinions freely, she might arouse alarm in the rest of my guinea pigs. Enthused by my success at making ether, I had seriously underestimated the difficulty of inducing anyone to let me use it on them. Mr. Christie might well be an awkward bugger, as Jamie on occasion called him, but he was not alone in his resistance to the notion of being rendered suddenly unconscious. I would have thought that the appeal of painlessness was universal, but not to people who had never experienced it. They had no context in which to place such a notion, and while they presumably didn't all think ether was a papist plot, they did view an offer to remove pain from them as being in some way contrary to the divine vision of the universe. Bobby and Lizzie, though, were sufficiently under my sway that I was fairly sure I could coax or bully them into a brief trial. If they then reported the experience in a positive light, but improved public relations was only the half of it. The real necessity was to try my ether out on a variety of subjects, taking careful note of the results. The scare of Henri Christian's birth had shown me how woefully unprepared I was.
I needed to have some idea of how much to administer per unit of body weight, how long such and such a dose might last, and how deep the resulting stupor might be. The last thing I wanted was to be up to my elbows in someone's abdomen, only to have them come suddenly round with a shriek.
"You're doing it again, Mom."
Bobby's brow creased as he chewed slowly, eyes narrowed at me.
"What?
What am I doing?" I feigned innocence, helping myself to a bit of the pork pie.
"Watching me? Same as a sparrowhawk watches a mouse just afore she stoops, ain't she?"
He appealed to Lizzie.
"Aye, she is,"
Lizzie agreed, dimpling at me.
"But it's only your weekend. You'd make a big moose, Bobby."
Being Scottish, she pronounced it moose, which made Bobby laugh and choke over his muffin. Mrs. Bug paused to pound him helpfully on the back, leaving him purple and gasping.
"Well, what's amiss wi' him, then?"
she asked, coming round to squint critically at Bobby's face.
"You've no got the shits again, have you, lad?"
"Again?"
I said. "Oh, no, Mum," he croaked. "Perish the thought. 'Twas only eating green apples the once."
He choked, coughed, and sat up straight, clearing his throat.
"Can we please not talk about me bowels, Mum?"
he asked plaintively.
"Not over breakfast, at least."
I could feel Lizzie vibrating with amusement next to me, but she kept her eyes demurely on her plate, not to embarrass him further.
"Certainly,"
I said, smiling.
"I hope you'll be staying for a few days, Bobby."
He'd come the day before, bearing the usual assortment of letters and newspapers from Lord John, along with a package containing a marvellous present for Jemmy, a musical jack-in-the-box sent specially from London by the good offices of Lord John's son, Willie.
"Why, chow, Mum, yes,"
he assured me, mouth full of muffin.
"His lordship said I was to see if Mr. Fraser had a letter for me to carry back, so I must wait for him, mustn't I?"
"Of course." Jamie and Ian had gone to the Cherokee a week before. It was likely to be another week before they returned. Plenty of time to make my experiments.
"Is there anything I might do, Mum, in the way of service to you?"
Bobby asked.
"Seeing as I'm here, I mean, and Mr. Fraser and Mr. Ian not."
There was a small tone of satisfaction in this. He got on all right with Ian, but there was no doubt that he preferred to have Lizzie's attention to himself.
"Why, yes," I said, scooping up a bit of porridge. "Now that you mention it, Bobby."
By the time I had finished explaining, Bobby still looked healthy, but a good deal less in bloom.
"Put me asleep?" he repeated uncertainly.
He glanced at Lizzie, who looked a little uncertain too, but who was much too used to being told to do unreasonable things to protest.
"You'll only be asleep for a moment," I assured him. "Likely you won't even notice."
His face expressed considerable scepticism, and I could see him shifting about for some excuse. I'd foreseen that ploy, though, and now played my trump card.
"It's not only me needing to judge the dose," I said. "I can't operate on someone and give the ether at the same time. Or not easily. Malva Christie will be assisting me. She'll need the practice."
"Oh," Bobby said thoughtfully.
"Miss Christie."
A sort of soft, dreamy expression spread across his face.
"Well, we shouldn't want to put Miss Christie out, of course."
Lizzie made one of those economical Scottish noises in the back of her throat, managing to convey scorn, derision, and abiding disapproval in the space of two glottal syllables. Bobby looked up in inquiry, a bit of pie poised on his fork.
"Did you say something?"
"Who, me?" she said.
"Of course not."
She got up abruptly, and carrying her apron before her, neatly shook crumbs into the fire and turned to me.
"When do you mean to do it?"
she demanded, adding a belated, "Ma'am."
"Tomorrow morning," I said. "It needs to be done on an empty stomach, so we'll do it first thing, before breakfast."
"Fine," she said, and stamped out. Bobby blinked after her, then turned to me, bewildered.
"Did I say something?"
Mrs. Bug's eye met mine in perfect understanding.
"Not a thing, lad," she said, depositing a fresh spatula full of scrambled eggs onto his plate. "Eat up. You'll need your strength."
Brianna, clever with her hands, had made the mask to my specifications, woven of oak splits. It was simple enough, a sort of double cage, hinged so that the two halves of it swung apart for the insertion of a thick layer of cotton wool between them, and then back together, the whole thing shaped to fit like a catcher's mask over the patient's nose and mouth. "Put enough ether on to dampen the cotton wool all through," I instructed Mulva. "We'll want it to take effect quickly."
"Hi, ma'am." "Oh, it does smell queer, doesn't it?"
She sniffed cautiously, face turned halfway as she dripped ether onto the mask.
"Yes."
"Do be careful not to breathe too much of it yourself," I said. "We don't want you falling over in the midst of an operation." She laughed, but dutifully held the mask further away. Lizzie had bravely offered to go first, with the clear intent of deflecting Bobby's attention from Mulva to her. This was working. She lay in a languid pose on the table, cap off, and her soft, pale hair displayed to the best advantage on the pillow. Bobby sat beside her, earnestly holding her hand. "All right, then." I had a tiny minute glass to hand, the best I could do by way of keeping accurate time. "Put it gently over her face. Lizzie, just breathe deeply and count with me. 1, 2...
Goodness, that didn't take long, did it?
She'd taken one long breath, rib cage rising high, and then gone limp as a dead flounder as the breath went out. I hastily flipped the glass and came to take her pulse. All well there. "Wait for a bit. You can feel it when they start to come round, a sort of vibration in the flesh," I instructed Mulva, keeping one eye on Lizzie and the other on the glass. "Put your hand on her shoulder. There. Do you feel it?" Mulva nodded, nearly trembling with excitement. 2 or 3 drops, then." She added these, her own breath held, and Lizzie relaxed again with a sigh like an escape of air from a punctured tire. Bobby's blue eyes were absolutely round, but he clung fiercely to Lizzie's other hand. I timed the period to arousal once or twice more, then let Mulva put her under a little more deeply. I picked up the lancet I had ready and pricked Lizzie's finger. Bobby gasped as the blood welled up, looking back and forth from the crimson drop to Lizzie's angelically peaceful face.
"Why, she don't feel it," he exclaimed. "Look, she's never moved a muscle."
"Exactly," I said, with a profound feeling of satisfaction. "She won't feel anything at all until she comes round."
"Mrs. Freezer says we could cut someone quite open," Mulva informed Bobby self-importantly. "Slice into them and get at what's ailing, and they'd never feel a thing."
"Well, not until they woke up," I said, amused. "They'd feel it then, I'm afraid. But it really is quite a marvellous thing," I added more softly, looking down at Lizzie's unconscious face. I let her stay under whilst I checked the fresh blood sample, then told Mulva to take the mask off. Within a minute, Lizzie's eyelids began to flutter. She looked curiously round, then turned to me.
"When are you going to start it, ma'am?"
Despite assurances from both Bobby and Mulva that she had been to all appearances dead as a doornail for the last quarter hour, she refused to believe it, asserting indignantly that she couldn't have been, though at a loss to explain the prick on her finger and the slide of freshly smeared blood. "You remember the mask on your face?" I asked, "and my telling you to take a deep breath?" She nodded uncertainly.
"Aye, I do. Then..."
And it felt for a moment as though I were choking. "But then you were all just staring down at me next thing." "Well, I suppose the only way to convince her is to show her," I said, smiling at the 3 flushed young faces. "Bobby?" Eager to demonstrate the truth of the matter to Lizzie, he hopped up on the table and laid himself down with a will,
though the pulse in his slender throat was hammering as Mulver dripped ether on the mask. He drew a deep, convulsive gasp the moment she put it on his face. Frowning a bit, he took another, one more, and went limp. Lizzie clapped both hands to her mouth, staring.
"Jesus, Joseph and Mary," she exclaimed.
Mulver giggled, thrilled at the effect.
Lizzie looked at me, eyes wide, then back at Bobby. Stooping to his ear, she called his name, to no effect, then picked up his hand and wiggled it gingerly. His arm waggled limply, and she made a soft exclamation and set his hand down again. She looked quite agitated.
"Can he no wake up again?"
"Not until we take away the mask," Mulver told her, rather smug.
"Yes, but you don't want to keep someone under longer than you need to," I added. "It's not good for them to be anesthetized too long."
Mulver obediently brought Bobby back to the edge of consciousness and put him back under several times, while I made note of times and dosages. During the last of these notes, I glanced up to see her looking down at Bobby with an intense sort of expression, seeming to concentrate on something.
Lizzie had withdrawn to a corner of the surgery, plainly made uneasy by seeing Bobby unconscious, and sat on a stool, plaiting her hair and twisting it up under her cap. I stood up and took the mask from Mulver's hand, setting it aside. "You did a wonderful job," I told her, speaking quietly. "Thank you."
She shook her head, face glowing. "Oh, ma'am, it was... I've never seen the like. It's such a feeling, is it not? Like as we killed him and brought him alive again."
She spread her hands out, looking at them half unconsciously, as though wondering how she'd done such a marvel, then closed them into small fists and smiled at me conspiratorially.
"I think I see why my father says it's devil's work. Were he to see what it's like?"
She glanced at Bobby, who was beginning to stir.
"He'd say no one but God has a right to do such things."
"Really?" I said, rather dryly. From the gleam in her eye, her father's likely reaction to what we'd been doing was one of the chief attractions of the experiment.
For an instant, I rather pitied Tom Christie.
Perhaps you'd better not tell your father then," I suggested. She smiled, showing small, sharp, white teeth, and rolled her eyes.
"Don't you think it, ma'am?" she assured me. "He'd stop me coming as quick as..."
Bobby opened his eyes, turned his head to one side, and threw up, putting a stop to the discussion. Lizzie gave a cry and hurried to his side, fussing over him, wiping his face, and fetching him brandy to drink. Mulver, looking slightly superior, stood aside and let her.
"Ooh, that's queer," Bobby repeated for perhaps the tenth time, rubbing a hand across his mouth. "I saw the most terrible thing, just for a moment there. And then I felt sick, and here it was all over." "What sort of terrible thing?" Mulver asked, interested. He glanced at her, looking wary and uncertain.
"I scarcely know, tell you true, miss. Only as it was dark-like. A form, as you might see. I thought 'twas a woman's, but terrible," he finished, helpless. "Well, that was too bad. Hallucination wasn't an uncommon side effect, but I hadn't expected it with such a brief dose. Well, I imagine it was just a bit of nightmare," I said soothingly. "You know, it's a form of sleep, so it's not surprising that you might get the odd bit of dreaming now and then." To my surprise, Lizzie shook her head at this.
"Oh, no, ma'am," she said. "It's no sleep at all. When you sleep, Ken, you give your soul up to the angels' keeping, so as no ghoulies shall come near. But this..."
Frowning, she eyed the bottle of ether, now safely corked again, then looked at me.
"I did wonder," she said. "Where does your soul go?"
I said. "Well, I should think it simply stays with your body. It must. I mean, you aren't dead." Both Lizzie and Bobby were shaking their heads decidedly,
No, it doesn't, Lizzie said. When you're sleeping, you're still there. When you do that...
She gestured toward the mask, a faint uneasiness on her small features.
You're not.
That's true, Mum, Bobby assured me. You're not.
You think maybe you go to limbo with the unbaptized babes and all?
Lizzie asked anxiously. Malva gave an unladylike snort.
Limbo's no real place, she said. It's only a notion thought up by the Pope.
Lizzie's mouth dropped open in shock at this blasphemy, but Bobby luckily distracted her by feeling dizzy and requiring to lie down. Malva seemed inclined to go on with the argument, but beyond repeating "the Pope" once or twice, simply stood, swaying to and fro with her mouth open, blinking a little. I glanced at Lizzie, only to find her glassy-eyed as well. She gave an enormous yawn and blinked at me, eyes watering. It occurred to me that I was beginning to feel a trifle light-headed myself.
Goodness!
I snatched the ether mask from Malva's hand and guided her hastily to a stool. Let me get rid of this or we'll all be giddy. I flipped open the mask, pulled the damp wad of cotton wool out of it, and carried it outside at arm's length. I'd opened both the surgery windows to provide ventilation and save us all being gassed, but ether was insidious. Heavier than air, it tended to sink toward the floor of a room and accumulate there, unless there was a fan or some other device to remove it. I might have to operate in the open air, I thought, were I using it for any length of time. I laid the cotton wool pad on a stone to dry out and came back, hoping that they were all too groggy now to continue their philosophical speculations. I didn't want them following that line of thought. Let it get around the ridge that ether separated people from their souls, and I never get anyone to let me use it on them, no matter how dire the situation. Well, thank you all for helping, I said, smiling as I entered the room, relieved to find them all looking reasonably alert. You've done something very useful and valuable. You can all go along about your business now, though. I'll tidy up. Malva and Lizzie hesitated for a moment, neither girl wanting to leave Bobby to the other, but under the impetus of my shooing, drifted toward the door.
"When are you to be wed, Miss Weems?"
Malva asked casually, and loudly enough for Bobby to hear, though she certainly knew. Everyone on the ridge did.
"In August?" Lizzie replied coolly, lifting her small nose half an inch. "Right after the haying, Miss Christie."
"And then I shall be Mrs. McGillivray," her satisfied expression said. "And you, Miss Christie, without an admirer to your name?"
Not that Malva attracted no notice from young men, only that her father and brother were assiduous in keeping them away from her.
"I wish you great joy of it," Malva said.
She glanced at Bobby Higgins, then back at Lizzie, and smiled, demure beneath her starched white cap. Bobby stayed sitting on the table for a moment, looking after the girls.
"Bobby," I said, struck by the deeply thoughtful expression on his face, "the figure you saw under the anaesthetic, did you recognize it?"
He looked at me, then his eyes slid back to the empty doorway, as though unable to keep away.
"Oh, no, Mum," he said, in such a tone of earnest conviction that I knew he lied. "Not at all."
Chapter 43. Displaced Persons. They had stopped to water the horses by the edge of the small lake the Indians called Thick Rushes. It was a warm day, and they hobbled the horses, stripped, and waded into the water, spring-fed and gloriously cold. Cold enough to shock the senses, and for a moment at least, drive away Jamie's moody contemplation of the note MacDonald had delivered him from John Stewart, the Indian superintendent of the Southern Department. It had been complimentary enough, praising his celerity and enterprise in drawing the snowbird Cherokee into the British sphere of influence, but had gone on to urge more vigorous involvement, pointing out Stewart's own coup in directing the choice of leaders among the Choctaws and the Chickasaw, at a congress he had himself convened 2 years before. The competition and anxiety of the candidates for medals and commissions was as great as can be imagined, and equaled the struggles of the most aspiring and ambitious for honours and preferment in great states. I took every step to be informed of characters and filled the vacancies with the most worthy and likely to answer the purposes of maintaining order and the attachment of this nation to the British interest. I urge you to strive for similar good results to be achieved among the Cherokee.
"Oh, aye," he said aloud, popping up among the rushes and shaking water from his hair.
"I'm to depose Siskwa, nee doot, by assassination, and bribe them all to install Pipestone Carver,"
the smallest and most self-effacing Indian Jamie had ever seen, "as peace chief." He sang again, in a rush of bubbles, entertaining himself by cursing Stuart's presumption, watching his words rise up in wavering quicksilver balls to disappear magically at the bright light of the surface. He rose again, gasping, then gulped air, and held his breath.
"What was that?" said a startled voice nearby. "Is it them?"
"No, no," said another, low and urgent. "There are only two. I see them both over there. Do you see?"
He opened his mouth and breathed like a zephyr, striving to hear over the pounding of his heart. He had understood them, but for an instant couldn't put a name to their tongue. Indians, aye, but not Cherokee. They were Tuscarora. That was it. He hadn't spoken with any Tuscarora for years. Most of them had gone north in the wake of the measles epidemic that had destroyed so many, going to join their Mohawk fathers in the lands ruled by the Iroquois League. These two were arguing in whispers, but near enough that he made out most of what they said. They were no more than a few feet from him, hidden by a thick growth of rushes and cattail plants that stood nearly as high as a man's head. Where was Ian? He could hear distant splashing at the far end of the lake, and, turning his head gently, saw from the corner of his eye that Ian and Rollo were sporting in the water, the dogs submerged to his ruff, paddling to and fro. If one didn't know, and the beast didn't sense the intruders and bark, it looked very much like two men swimming. The Indians had concluded that this was likely the case. Two horses, thus two men, and both safely distant. With much creaking and rustling, they began to make their way stealthily in the direction of the horses. Jamie was half inclined to let them try to take Gideon and see how far they got with such an enterprise. But they might only make off with Ian's horse and the pack mule, and Claire would be fashed did he let them take Clarence. Feeling himself very much at a disadvantage, he slithered naked through the reeds, grimacing at the rasp of them on his skin, and crawled up among the cattails into the mud of the shore. Had they the wit to look back, they must have seen the cattails shaking, and he hoped Ian would see, but they were intent on their errand. He could glimpse them now, skulking in the tall grass at the forest edge, glancing to and fro, but never in the right direction. Only two, he was sure of that now, young from the way they moved, and unsure. He couldn't see if they were armed. Slimed with mud, he crept further, sinking onto his belly in the rank grasses near the lake, squirming rapidly toward the shelter of a sumac bush. What he wanted was a club, and quickly. In such circumstances, of course, nothing came to hand but twigs and long-rotted branches. For lack of better, he seized a good-sized stone, but then found what he wanted, a dogwood branch cracked by wind and hanging in reach still attached to the tree. They were approaching the grazing horses now. Gideon saw them and lifted his head abruptly. He went on chewing, but his ears lay half back in patent suspicion. Clarence, the ever-sociable, took notice and raised his head as well, ears twitching to alertness. Jamie seized the chance, and as Clarence emitted a welcoming bray, he ripped the branch from the tree and charged the intruders, roaring,
to La Harge!"
at the top of his voice. Wide eyes met his, and one man bolted, long hair flying. The other followed, but limping badly, going down on one knee as something gave way. He was up again at once, but too slow. Jamie swept the branch at his leg with a two-handed fury that knocked him flat, and leapt on his back, driving a vicious knee into his kidney. The man made a strangled noise and froze, paralyzed by pain. Jamie had dropped his rock. No, there it was. He snatched it up and thumped the man solidly behind the ear for luck. Then he was off and running after the other, who had made for the wood but sheered off, blocked by a rock-bound streamlet in his path. Now the man was bounding through the sedges. Jamie saw him cast a terrified look toward the water, where Ian and Rollo were making their way toward him, swimming like beaver. The Indian might have made it to the sanctuary of the forest had one foot not sunk suddenly in soft mud. He staggered sideways, and Jamie was on him, feet sliding in the mud, grappling. The man was young and wiry and fought like an eel.